Welcome to the Echo Effect podcast series, where we unravel the intricate interplay between war and environment through engaging and thought-provoking conversations. The series is created and moderated by Inés Montalbán, Program Director at Artists with Evidence, who is joined by two featured speakers, transmedia artist and curator Ali Akbar Mehta, and distinguished poet and humanist Colin Greer. With a constellation of insightful guests, we will delve into critical issues such as climate change, resource scarcity, mass migration, and democratic erosion, as well as other unexpected topics that intertwine with war and environment in unforeseen ways. Echo Effect, Conversations on War and Environment, is a program funded by the Nordic Culture Fund, who awarded Artists with Evidence with the Globus Upstart Grant for 2024.
So I want to welcome everyone to this session. The name of this conversation is Desert Roots, Growing Hope in the Sahrawi Refugee Camps. And today we have Ali Akbar Mehta, one of our usual speakers. Unfortunately, Colin Greer is not joining us today. He was feeling a bit under the weather, so we hope he recovers and then he'll join us back in the sixth and last conversation of this series. And I'm really happy to have with us Mohamed Labat joining us from home. It's beautiful out there. He was showing us right before we joined where he's joining us from. And Echo Effect, for those who haven't joined one of our conversations before, it's a series of conversations online about war and environment. And it's funded by the Nordic Culture Fund. So Artists with Evidence, which is the organization behind this program, has gotten funding from the Nordic Culture Fund with an Upstart grant in 2024. And this is what brought us together with amazing guests that we've been having so far. And hopefully this will be, you know, kind of a something that will impact future projects too. And that's where we are putting our minds on. The idea behind Echo Effect was actually a collaboration that we started idealizing with Ali and Colin. And in this collaboration, so Ali has his work, he works a lot with archiving and has a really interesting work called Purgatory Edit. And we started discussing like how this archival of footage of violence and conflict could kind of intertwine with Colin's poetry. Colin is a poet, a humanist, and the president of the New World Foundation, which is a foundation that funds a lot of incredible projects, community-supported projects all over the world. So, and the idea was to kind of see how these two bodies of work and these two incredible people could join together, and then having AI looking at their work and recombining it and see what would the outcome be. And that would allow us to have kind of a critical look at AI and its role and its possibilities and its dangers in our world. The thing, we started talking about this, we would have some conversations online, and then my gut feeling was more people need to watch these conversations and get involved in them. And so that's how this this project, the Echo Effect series of conversations, came to be. And I think things took another turn in a sense that we were thinking that the conversations could be almost a parallel program. And then it's kind of the thing that is starting the collaboration, because we're getting so many different points of view from, you know, from fermentation to nuclear weapons. So there's been very diverse topics. Anyway, today I'm really happy to introduce you to Mohamed Labat, who was born and raised in the Sahrawi refugee camps. These are long-term refugee camps, and has been having incredibly innovative and community-based projects that we'll be hearing about today. So welcome, Mohammed and Ali.
Thank you, Ines, for having me.
Thank you, Ines, for the conversation
as well.
Yeah, I would, just to like, you know, kickstart this, I was wondering if you could share with us how your artistic practice works to preserve, for example, the oral traditions of the Sahrawi people. So especially in this context where physical displacement risks erasing cultural identity. You've been documenting poems and stories that carry kind of, that carry the memory of the nomadic Sahrawi life. And so how do you balance this role of preserving those traditions while also adapting to all the modern challenges that you face?
Well, thank you so much for having me in this incredible series of conversations. You know, living in the refugee camps all my life, I came to realize that I'm living a reality, but also kind of in the middle of another reality that I have never been into. And so I know I'm here in this place, but the everyday reality often keeps reminding me that I don't belong here either. And so it's a refugee camp supposed to be temporary, but it's been taking too long. My parents arrived here almost 50 years ago, and I was born here. A whole new generation is born here. And all we hear about are from our parents and grandparents telling us about our roots, where they come from, a place where they thought they would go back to any time. They thought they would go back in the first week, and then they thought, oh, it's going to take a month, mm-hmm. and they take a year, and then it's 50 years in the refugee camps. But living with some of the realities in the refugee camps often reminds me that no matter how long I have been living here, this is not my place, mm-hmm. even if I was born here. Because, for example, when I go to Algerian universities, and Algeria has hosted the Sahrawi for a long time, and we studied in Algerian universities, but when you go to schools, you apply as an international student. You're not Algerian. And also the day-to-day reality here reminds you that, okay, the camps surrounded by, you know, the tents and living here, all the architecture and the landscape express a strong feeling of temporariness, that, you know, the people here are not settling down, even though they have been here for a long time. There's always the hope that they will go back to our homeland. And so it's at that kind of border of here and there that I started to have these conversations with my father, who lived much of his life as a nomad in Western Sahara. And then when the war broke out, they had to escape the war and come to the refugee camps. And I'm like, okay, so can you tell me about how you lived in Western Sahara and where our family lived, and how does the places you've lived in, how do they look like, and what did you do? And so he started to tell me these incredible stories of their lives and how they lived in different places. And he just opened a window into another world that I have never imagined in my life. Because the Sahrawi now in the refugee camps, they cannot practice nomadic way of living. Of course, some people still have camels and goats, but they cannot roam and move the way they used to do when they were in Western Sahara. That's also realizing that my generation, the younger generation, don't have access anymore to Western Sahara, not to the place, but also to a lot of the practices and the culture that the Sahrawi had, makes it very, very important for me to preserve as much as I can from what I can have access to from my parents, from the elderly in our community. So we started to record We started to write down, started to document and make some interviews. Sometimes it's methodically prepared and organized way. We sit down and we have questions, set of questions to talk about something. But sometimes it just happens. We're sitting at a tea, we're making tea at home every day. And then my father talked about something incredible. I'm like, oh, what are my equipment?
Hold on, I need to record this.
Yes. yeah.
How does, could you tell a bit about the nomadic calendar and how it kind of links to that?
Yeah, I mean, throughout the process of preserving, documenting the oral history of the Sahrawi, I kept thinking about, okay, there's often a lot of references to Western writings about the Sahrawi, the Spanish and other people who have written about the Sahrawi, and different other foreigners who have visited the Sahrawi people in the past or now, which I'm not really totally happy with some of their writings, some of their portraying that has been done, not all of them. But it just got me to think, okay, a lot has been written about us, but how would we portray ourselves? How would we represent ourselves? And so I started to ask basic questions of how can we tell who we are based on something we have already practiced? And through the conversations, my father kept telling me, kept referring to the nomadic calendar in different ways until I realized, okay, so there is actually a different way of telling time than what I'm used to in schools, and because I was educated in contemporary schools in Algeria, not in the traditional way, and so I asked him more about it, and he started to tell me, you have to know more. He tells me something, and then after like a week or something, then he comes back to the topic, and so it's kind of spread all over the time, and so the nomadic calendar is a way the Sahrawi people use to tell time. And it's non-numerical calendar. It's an event-based calendar. Every year actually had a name instead of a number. And so instead of saying, I was born in 1960 or 30 or something, they would say, I was born in the year of the red wind, or the year of the flood, the year of the scattering stars, the year of, it refers to some plants. There's a huge variety of the kinds of things the Sahrawi use to name, to illustrate their nomadic calendar. They refer to geographic places. They refer to plants. For example, if some plants popped up after some rain that they have never seen before, they would give it a name, and then the year would name be, for example, Aam al-Yalma, which is the year of Yalma, a plant that popped up some year, and they called the year after that plant.
I'm sure you now know what was your year that you were born. Do you know then what was the year that you were born? How was it described?
Well, the sad thing is that the nomadic calendar stopped with the disruption of the way of living when the Sahrawi left Western Sahara, because they cannot they kind of started to be lost, and that's why I'm really urgently starting to document as much as I can before the elderly die. And so the nomadic calendar preserved much of not just the history, but also the landscape, the practices, the events, social, cultural, political events in the Sahrawi history. And it became kind of, I felt like this is a way that the Sahrawi, this is the Sahrawi history and the Sahrawi knowledge. I can just start to go back to how the Sahrawi expressed themselves and named the landscape around them, the practice they were doing, the life around them, plants, animals,
the memory, of course.
And
I wanna pull Ali into this, because I think it's really interesting if we think about archives, but kind of taking it into our own hands in that sense, that it's not about someone archiving someone else's memories, but you take it upon yourself. So in this context of like conflict and displacement, like in the Sahrawi camps, how can these archives and memory be used as tools of resistance? So I'd like to have your Ali's input. Like, how do you see this intersection of violence and memory that you approached with your archival practices in this context?
Well, I think Muhammad already talked about it so well, in the sense that a certain people's identity and a cultural identity, a preservation of a way of life as a kind of an identity, is so important in the way in which we think about ourselves as a people, as a community, as something to belong to. And maybe not to specifically refer to what Muhammad has spoken about, because he has already said it so beautifully. But I think what you kind of right now mentioned, in terms of taking the agency of archiving and preserving these memories, and I think that is something that has become increasingly important in the way that we have been thinking about the role of memory and identity as a kind of a marker of resistance, identity itself as a marker of resistance, where it's no longer something that is passive to be protected, but is an active tool in actually speaking out against the erasure of one's being. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, I think it is also very important to recognize that state and infrastructural archives or legacy archives, and by this I mean specifically those kind of institutional modes of memory making of a specific kind of a dominant culture, of a specific kind of a dominant history that has a certain kind of a top-down approach that does not actually treat the data or the memory or the history of a people as something that belongs to them, but needs to be in a way crafted as a tool for further oppression. These kind of systems, these kind of archival systems are historically, and now we recognize this, they're historically loaded with a kind of a colonial, and now of course also a neo-colonial oppression, a neoliberal oppression, a kind of a capitalist framework where data, and this is maybe not a very relevant conversation to have within this specific context, but I see it very much connected in the way that in our daily practices of data generation and actually engaging with digital infrastructures that surround us, the way that data extractivism actually functions is exactly in the same vein of a neoliberal, neo-colonial and colonial legacy of of acquisition and control. And so in that frame of reference, so just so that we understand exactly what is at stake here, it's not just that the quote-unquote oral traditions of the Sahrawi people or the quote-unquote identity frameworks of people who are recognizably under certain kinds of oppressions and marginalization, but in a way it extends to all of us who are in a way implicated and complicit in the kind of infrastructures of knowledge and memory making today, that we all need to understand that there are certain kind of systems that have been historically used to control and govern, and the word is it will come to me. But yes, govern is a kind of correct word.
Mm.
Sorry?
Yes, go on. Sorry.
I missed what you said, Ines.
No, I was
Okay.
just asking.
That there is an agency in the way in which we can actually take on archiving as a practice to counter that and counter the effects of that kind of historical oppression, contemporary oppression, ongoing oppression.
Yeah, and I think we'll be going into other topics related to food and growing your own food. So there's also something similar if we think about seeds, for example, and seed preservation and, not leaving it to the hands of others, but trying to, keep growing seeds that are more traditional varieties and not falling into the norm and what has been thought to be like scalable and so I think that will kind of come up in our conversation. Before we move on, I would like to throw a poll. We usually do a few polls over the conversation. I would love the first poll that we wanna ask, just get a feel for our crowd in relation to this topic. So in this poll, we're asking how familiar are you with the history of the Sahrawi people and their displacement? And very familiar, somewhat familiar, or not familiar. So maybe we share the poll and we can see that the most voted answer is actually not familiar, which it's maybe not surprising. Of course, it depends a bit on the audience that we have, but I'm actually glad because then we can also share about what is happening there or what has been happening. So I would like to, because this is a conversation obviously about war and environment, I wanted to, in a community that has endured all these years of displacement due to political conflict, can you discuss like how your work, Mohammed, captures this relationship between war, environment, and of course the experience of living in the desert? And how do you think that art, and you can tell us a bit about like what you've created also there, can help us understand how it can help us understand the link between environmental degradation and human displacement?
Yeah, there's definitely a very strong link, one that doesn't often get expressed, perhaps, or articulated this way, because a lot of people think this is a political conflict, but it's also a very environmental issue, because Western Sahara was colonized by Spain since 1884 or something until 1975. During this time, in this 650s, 60s, sorry, there's a lot of flies here. They found phosphate. They discovered phosphate in Western Sahara. And phosphate is a very precious mineral that is widely used as a fertilizer in many industrial agricultural farms around the world. And these phosphate mines have became the center or the kind of the reason for many colonial powers to arrive in Western Sahara, including Spain, Morocco, Mauritania, and so there's Western Sahara has some of the biggest phosphate mines in the world, not the biggest, but some of the biggest. And phosphate extracted from Western Sahara gets shipped to many other parts of the world to create the food that people eat, including parts of the Baltic Sea, to Lithuania and Russia and other places, and so and also to New Zealand and Australia, North America, to Canada and America, and also to Brazil and India. So it goes to many places around the world, but without the consent of the Sahrawi people. The discovery of phosphate, the extraction of phosphate, the exploration of phosphate was the reason that led to the displacement of the Sahrawi people, because the phosphate mines are located in this area to the east of Laayoune, the capital of Western Sahara. And around this rich area of phosphate, when the war broke out in the 1970s, Morocco started to build this wall, this military berm to protect these phosphate mines. Now, this berm, a lot of people don't know about, started to expand over the years until it kind of divided Western Sahara into two. And now it's 2,700 kilometers. I repeat, 2,700 kilometers. And it's fortified with millions of anti-personnel landmines. So the area, this practice makes it impossible for the Sahrawi to be nomads again. So the Sahrawi can no longer move in the desert as they used to be, because the Western Sahara is one of the most heavily polluted areas with landmines. These landmines and berms, walls, are there to, they were established first to around the phosphate mines, and then they started to expand them to keep the Sahrawi away. And so this war is about also such environmental catastrophes. The berm is creating a huge divide in Western Sahara, but also these insanely huge amounts of landmines looting this area. For what? How many are the Sahrawi? Even I don't know what the estimations now, but it could be less than 1 million people. So we have so many landmines per person, and it's just horrible. The destruction that they cause, the problems that they cause to the people, to the camels, to the herds, to the land. There have been some efforts to demine areas in Western Sahara, but it's very slow. And it's very dangerous because, of course, it's a desert and it hardly rains. But when it does, floods could actually transplant landmines to other areas. So it became the nomads try to avoid areas close to the berm. But areas that are very far from the berm, people have actually stepped on landmines because the floods carry landmines to other areas. It's again the same story of colonial powers arriving in some areas and discovering some minerals and then pushing away the indigenous people in order to excavate and exploit and those natural resources. The displacement of the Sahrawi is no exception from that narrative of extraction of natural resources of different indigenous communities around the world. Sadly, it's really sad that not many people know about this story, but it doesn't get much attention in the news. Largely because the Sahrawi for the past 50 years have been using nonviolent means, peaceful ways of demonstrating and raising, awareness through different creative practices using culture and arts and festivals and things. But the media is not paying attention to this because the Sahrawi are not waging war, because they're not using violence. They're not bombing or killing anyone. The media is only interested in destruction and interested in places where there is war and bombing and killing, perpetuating this violence. But the Sahrawi have had long 50 years of, amazing programs of festivals and arts and culture and community life. But the world we live in is so what is the word to describe? It's just so sick that they there's a lot of the talk about, okay, we need to do this non-violently, we need to but when the Sahrawi do it, nobody is listening to them.
We'll be going also into kind of how this minerals extraction and environmental damage also intersect with community resilience through farming, for example, and like these projects you've been doing. But maybe this would be a good moment to share maybe a trailer of your film, because I think that will showcase a bit of also like what are these means that through art and art science that you can, bring these topics to the stage.
رايت رابها تسافر قاطع البحر والمحيط واحد شاف يقد يقول اللي أنا وطحت على الخضار وتوه. هذيك النبي غدخنا هي السر في ذاك الخضار. احنا ما نعرف ذا غير قالوا عن ذاك الغبار رافد معاه جزيئات الفوسفور وهو سماد ذيك الغابات ذيك السهول اللي يطيح عليها. كل شيء يعمله صغير ويتخن وهي قاعد يقعد يطعم كذا الرمل والغبار غير عنده دور في الحياة ودور مهم تحنيه الغابات وأشجارها والسهول وخضارها. ما خارج شيء أزين من حد يوكل من ذا اللي ينتج بيه. ريحة النبات وطعمته بنسمته تحس عنك عدلت شيء مهم وشاركت في نمو الإنسان والنبات والأرض.
We'll also share the link to the trailer in the chat. And so this already unfolds a little bit of other things that you've been working on. So you're a multi-talented person. And so you've been working also on food production in the desert through small-scale farming for which the Sandoponic Garden is a fascinating example. And so I think that if you could explain how it works and how these efforts are contributing to both food security and climate resilience in your community, that would be really incredible to hear about.
Well, thank you. So this part of the conversation is not really disconnected from phosphate because I was working on a project in the camps and in Finland as well, in collaboration with the Finnish artist Pekka Niskanen, funded by Kona Foundation a couple of years ago, the project investigates the impact of phosphorus or phosphate on these two different environments, the Baltic Sea and the Western Sahara. A lot of people don't realize, but there is actually a connection because some of the phosphate from Western Sahara has ended up in the Baltic Sea, and the phosphate is creating a big problem in the Baltic Sea because some industrial farming are using phosphorus and processed phosphorus as a fertilizer in farming, and then it leaks into the Baltic Sea and creates eutrophication. Algae feeds on this excess phosphorus and then it grows crazy and then it causes oxygen depletion and causes even a lot of other damage to other marine life. When we talked to artists and scientists as well in Helsinki, we kept thinking about this paradox that a desert that is the phosphate of the source of phosphate but no farming, and then there's the Baltic Sea area thriving with farming but creating a desert in the bottom of the sea because phosphate is killing parts of the Baltic Sea that scientists are talking about some dead zones because of this effect. And we realize also that this is because of the way farming is being practiced because, and it's also connected to this idea of fertilization of human input and human intervention in different ecosystems. And it's also another form of violence where we bring or huge amounts of some minerals are being brought from certain geographic places, put in other ecosystems, and this creates this misbalance and creates this other impact on other systems and other places that we don't get to see. And so through those discussions also comes the realization that local practices, local happenings impact other parts of the world. At the same time, there's this big paradox that the Sahrawi were nomads, but now are starting to farm and coming from a place that is full of phosphate, but they're not using phosphate to grow food. And so in the Sahrawi refugee camps, a Sahrawi agriculture engineer who studied conventional agronomy and agricultural practices, but also coupled it with permaculture practices, people like Bill Mollison and others, have come back to the camps and started spreading knowledge of how to farm on small scale. So I shouldn't take credit of initiating or creating these gardens. I'm only part of the movement, collaborating and learning from the people who do it, the people, the families who are practicing it. And so what is happening is small-scale farming largely is started because they realize that the Sahrawi are dependent on food aid. They have been dependent on food aid for a long time. And food aid in the refugee camps is very limited in the nutritional value. And so the idea was, okay, if the families could learn how to set up small-scale family gardens, then they will be able to add some nutritional food to their diet. But based on that, the actually unique knowledge of how to farm in the desert started to develop, including the last, so they started with a lot of experimentation. They first brought this hydroponic systems, and then they brought some other systems, but they were either too complicated or technologically advanced or very expensive. But Tal Ibrahim, the agriculture engineer, the Sahrawi agriculture engineer who started to develop this movement, actually was able to recreate some of these systems using local materials and knowledges and customize it to the local situation. And so the sandoponic is one of the last farming models being adopted now in many areas, including in Samarra camp where I am, because there is very little water. So the sandoponic is a model that is built on that builds on the hydroponic system. And hydroponic is basically water-based farming. People can grow plants directly in water with some nutrients in it. But we can't afford to have water exposed because it will evaporate very quickly. So the idea is, if you contain the growing medium in some other material than water, then you will be able to preserve the water for a very long time. And so we started to have these sand gardens or sandoponic gardens a few years ago, maybe a couple of years ago. And we started to test because we had a small garden before that just in the ground, and it hardly produced anything because the moment you water it, the water just gets sucked by the desert or it evaporates very quickly because of the sun, exposure to the sun. But with the sandoponic garden, I started to test for how long it can keep the moisture. And it went for 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, up to 7 days. I went to a maximum of 10 days without watering it. Can you imagine watering your garden three times a month? This is a huge, improvement. Of course, this is only part of the story because the sand doesn't contain any organic material for the plants to absorb them. So parallel to preserving the water, we would make all sorts of bio-liquid fertilizers made from compost and food leftover and fermentation, working with the microbes that would decompose different organic materials and make them available for the plants. But always turn them into liquid form so that there's always fluidity in the system. And so thanks to that, and these scientific but community also based inputs, because the agriculture engineers, the scientists are contributing input, but also families in the community are contributing inputs. So for example, some families are developing shade houses instead of greenhouses. We have a lot of sunlight. We don't need a lot of greenhouses, but we need shade houses. Oh, we do some greenhouses as well because it can get cold in at night,
Exactly.
especially in the winter. But for most of the year, it's sunny and hot, and so shade houses are, are what we need because we need to provide some shade for the plants. And so yeah, the gardens have been doing really amazingly, and people have had we've had the possibility to have. Not just tomatoes and lettuce and cucumber, but kale also. I brought some kale seeds from Finland, and they've been doing really well here. Some friends.
It does well here too.
Such a hardy, resistant, amazing plant. I love kale, and many families are also planting more and more kale that I got from
Different
my
type of
friend Tammy Sutton
resistance here,
in
but it's
Helsinki.
still right. It's still dealing with harsh weathers and how you can still grow food. And this is interesting because it's made me think about something I read actually today, that right now, or post industrial revolution, and when we're so depending on fossil fuels, you need 10 calories to put in to be put in to produce 1 calorie, to get 1 calorie out of it. And before the industrial revolution, you would need 1 calorie to produce 3 calories. So it's interesting to see the impact and how it has shifted and made it so much more demanding in terms of like the energy sources, and that, it's the easy way, but it's also not necessarily the more optimal way, right? So it's really impressive to see how this is working in the context of the desert. I would like to make a small provocation just about, you hear a lot about projects about greening the desert, and we had a few exchanges about that. So why we shouldn't be talking about greening the desert? Why is this really just about growing food, and what does that entail when someone says greening the desert?
Well, part of that actually a little bit comes in the film that you just played. My father has this wisdom to talk about how the desert is impacting other parts of the world because we have huge sandstorms. You saw a little bit of that in the film, and those sandstorms are can be violent and destructive locally. But we're not angry at them. We just understand that they exist. But we now understand that they have a huge role to play around the world. They carry phosphorus particles, actually, and they travel crossing the Atlantic Ocean and they land in the Amazon. So those sandstorms carry phosphorus particles to fertilize the Amazon. This is a natural phenomenon. This is not man-made phenomenon, and there are like other projects around other parts of the desert, maybe not here in the refugee camps, that are trying to grow forests and trees on a very, very big scale to stop the advancement of the desert. The desert is coming, but that has a huge future impact on the world because as more and more greenery exists in the desert, it actually impacts the amount of phosphorus that gets lifted by sandstorms in order to fertilize the Amazon. If you green the desert, you kill the Amazon. So what we focus on and what we try to emphasize is that this is by no far green in the desert. This is small scale, local, that is aiming at producing very important and needed food for the community. We don't want to green the desert. We just want to live here. Actually, that brings me to another connection to how we relate to the world around us. We want to create something, but to what extent do we intervene as human beings so as to change the world around us? We Many people argue that we are in the age of the Anthropocene, of human interventions reshaping the surface of the earth because of our interventions. And that's largely true because over the past century, there has been a lot of extraction, excavation, manipulation of landscapes that have impacted not just local ecosystems, but also global ecosystems, because we intervene and we make something without irrationally, irresponsibly, not thinking about other parts of the world and other living beings, and we impact them whether we know it or not. The story of phosphate from the desert or Western Sahara impacting the Baltic Sea or impacting the Amazon is a strong example of how local practices and local phenomena have impact on other parts of the world. And so we should be aware of those phenomena and those practices. And I think the wisdom of the elderly, and my father, for example, he speaks in the film that, okay, he doesn't know how these sandstorms are impacting the world, but he's not angry with them. He let them exist because they do other things around the world. So we should be guided by that kind of wisdom, that the actions and the happenings and what is happening around us has something.
And the impact it will have, or how it will kind of have this ripple effect. I think that Ali, your work touches a lot on like this impact of memory in contexts of destruction. So in a way, how these communities can, through the use of memory, then advocate for environmental justice and other forms of justice. So
yes, I mean, I think we have throughout the series of these conversations, but also otherwise, been talking about how political conflicts, land occupation, resource occupation, wealth occupation, invasions, conflicts in general, have been connected to, has been a threat to climate security, has been a threat to food security, has been a threat to cultural security, has been a threat in a way to a certain kind of a stability of life. Yes, this is now understood. And I think in speaking about, I mean, listening to what Mohammed has been saying, actually, and just to also kind of point out that this work in a particular iteration was shown at the Helsinki Biennale in 2023, which was focusing on the idea of contamination, and contamination not just as a negative thing, but as a positive thing as well, or as a thing to be actually looked at critically in terms of what does it mean for contamination to occur and for, and who are the contaminants? And this is a very, one could simply look at it as an environmental or a climate question, but one could also look at it as a political question, because it is. And who are then the contaminants? Who are deemed to be artificial? Who are deemed to be the outsider, the migrant, the alien, the that which actually, by certain kind of logics, need to be removed, right? And this is perhaps something that, at least in specific, because Helsinki has such a strong, I mean, Finland generally has such a strong, also a civilian gardening culture, right? Which is also looking at kind of an alternate parallel subsistence farming and growing of agriculture. One thing that kind of one notices very strongly is the desire to weed out, right? And that for me is so interesting also in a way, because how did these weeds get there? Who brought them in? Why do they now need to be removed? How do we go about the practice of removing weeds? It's such a complicated, complex Complicated, maybe, yes, because it has multiple directions and multiple paths. But I mean, what is also very interesting is that the logic seems so clear. The logic seems clean, and there is a certain implementation to it. But it is complicated in the sense of certain plants were brought into Finland for the sake of aesthetic beauty and aestheticization, and only once they were brought in, did people realize that, oh, now they're taking over. You know, I mean, I'm just kind of bringing it as a thing to think about. I'm not trying to make a point here, but one thing that really kind of that I want to kind of point out, in line with Muhammad's work, the Sandokan Gardens in the Biennale, we also had another very interesting project by Interpret, which is a Trondheim-based collective in Sweden. And they were invited to actually do a project where they decided to look at the relationship between the Sami people and the states of Helsinki, the states of Finland, Norway, and Sweden, and specifically how certain green energies, again, quote unquote, green energies, disrupted the nomadic lives of the reindeer herders, and how something as green as wind energy, we agree that it is green energy, actually has other kind of political dimension of displacement, of affecting especially nomadic people's ways of lives that are so connected with and to land, more than I think people who are not nomadic. Yes, these are intricate and inherent parts of not just a kind of resource identity, but as a kind of a way of life they govern. And I mean, what Muhammad was also talking about, very fascinating. What he was talking about, the I will definitely ask more about that at some point in time. But these are then ways in which you realize that you are not at all in a way equipped to say what is important and what is not important. So this the inherent question of self-determination, of actually saying what is important to a way of life, to a kind of a cultural identity, needs to come from the people that these identities belong to, and these must be accepted as such. And so in that sense, and now arriving at responding to your question, Ines, sorry for the lead up, the long lead up. But in this sense, I think when we are talking about the kind of the state of the polycrisis that we're in, where there are around 205 ongoing conflicts in the world, where it is impossible to actually have equal attention given evenly and equally across the multiple crises that are not just political but also environmental, that are also happening in ways and in using, well, using is a very tame word, but by deploying or weaponizing our own ignorance, right? But there is a certain kind of a concerted effort to keep us ignorant. I think in that frame of reference, these two things of no longer being ignorant and believing, first of all, the people who say that this is important to be archived, to be preserved, to be amplified, to be shared, to be spoken out about, to be safeguarded, to be given privacy, to in solidarity, then therefore ask ask for accountability somewhere else. These are all things that we need to do. And at least for me, I think thinking about it from the perspective of knowledge production. Of course, knowledge production also is a very charged and loaded word, has very strong Western Western well, Western academic canon meaning. Yet, beyond that, despite that, maybe even because of that, I think it is important to actually kind of move forward in this way, to say that some things need to remain. And again, just kind of saying what Mohammed was talking about, if the desert is to, if the desert becomes green, the green will become a desert. There will be a certain kind of a natural balance and an equilibrium maintained. But that equilibrium is not an equilibrium that we are comfortable with, that we do not have the tools to understand it even. And so in that kind of a context, to actually move forward with a certain kind of a knowledge and an understanding of how to support things that need to be supported is important.
Yeah, speaking to all this issues that you've said, told us about, I wanted to maybe throw a poll to the to our audience. But in relation to food security, so kind of focusing on that crisis. And so we are asking, what do you think is the most pressing global issue in relation to food security? Is it climate change, political conflict, environmental degradation, or economic inequality? And just as a disclaimer, we always give only one choice. So you need to pick one choice. And interesting, I can see that. Okay, it's really jumping around, so many, many different options or answers, I mean. But I think that it feels like we have clear answer now, so maybe you can share the results of the poll. And what we got, kind of a somewhat of a balance between climate change and political conflict, and then economic inequality as kind of one in terms of answers. So if any of you would like to comment on this, do you agree, do you disagree? Thank you for the audience for voting.
I can say something. I think it's a bit of all of those things coming together. It's polar crisis situation that Ali was talking about, and the thing is that actually most of those challenges are inseparable. They all come together, and most of the political conflicts and problems are actually also situations of inequality and situations where climatic changes are the most visible, so it's the same thing manifested on different levels on multi layers, I think what is interesting is that a lot of people are starting to realize that, okay, the awareness about climate change, the environmental problems, maybe are trendy nowadays, these are the same conflicts and the same problems that humanity have been going on for a very long time. The roots of those problems are many, but they manifest themselves in different times with different wordings and different expressions and different articulations. But at the heart, we need to there's these deep problems that we need to work on as human beings, as a species, of how to live with each other and with the rest of the world, with the rest of the natural world around us. Those problems sometimes can come in different forms, I think.
Yeah, and I think it ties nicely with what we've been discussing, that climate change is not just a localized issue, right? So it's something that creates ripple effects worldwide and impacts, unfortunately, and first and foremost, marginalized and indigenous communities disproportionately compared to the rest of the world. So it calls for a deeper understanding of how these indigenous practices also offer these pathways for resilience and adaptation on a global scale. So you've spoken about the rise also of climate refugees. It's a topic that also comes up with kind of or perspires through your work and the challenges that are faced by your own community. But I would like to know, like, how do you think that these future waves of climate refugees or the threat of it can actually reshape global politics and economies, and particularly for marginalized groups?
Is a question for me or for Ali?
For you and Ali, it's really both of you, I think, can speak to.
I think that the Sahrawi story is kind of a really special story when it comes to refugees, because the Sahrawi are not coming to Europe. The Sahrawi only want to go back home, and of course the people are being driven for very they're being driven out of their places to other situations and other places, really out of their will. They're not, they didn't go intentionally to those places. They don't want to go. They just want to be somewhere. They're being driven, like, for political reasons, for environmental reasons, for war reasons. But the Sahrawi kind of make an exception, because the Sahrawi have been here for a very long time, for 50 years. If the Sahrawi want to go back to want to go to somewhere else, they should have gone like for the first 10 years or something. But there's only one reason we want to go. The Sahrawi want to go back home, and to our homeland. This makes this partly also makes part of the image, because it doesn't of what how it is problematic to bring this to the media, because the media wants to bring the story of refugees and migrants coming to Europe, taking over job positions and possibilities, but the Sahrawi don't fit that narrative, and so they don't come into the picture, and that's very problematic,
Yeah, indeed. Ali, do you want to comment on that?
Yes, I would ask you to maybe just repeat the question. I got busy reading
Yeah, there
the
is a.
chat. There was a question on the chat, so I missed your question. Could
Yeah.
you just repeat the question?
Yes. So we had a comment and two questions actually. One is where would the film be available if possible? That this person would love to get in contact with Mohammed, as they are part of my Migrant Movies student-led initiative of the in a Master of Arts in Ethnic and Migration Studies. So we can definitely put you in contact. You can also reach Mohammed through his website. So with the studio, Motif Arts Studio, we can add the link on the chat. And the other question, okay, it's really about the recording. Yes, we will have this recording put in our YouTube channel. So Artists with Evidence has a YouTube channel, and we put there all the recordings of the conversations that we have. But before we go ahead, I think that this reminds me of a lot of conversations that we have been having also about Indigenous knowledge, and that has come up in a lot of our conversations too. So I'm thinking about like how maybe Ali can answer to this, like how this preservation of Indigenous knowledge, either if it's through this kind of agency taken into archiving our own communities, but also like through oral preservation, oral traditions preservation. So how can this knowledge play also a critical role in addressing the global climate crisis? And what, of course, like what lessons can we learn from the Sahrawi, which have historically adapted to harsh environments? So it's a bit for both.
Yes, I think, yes, please go ahead, Mohammed.
Go ahead. I can follow.
Okay. I think the question of archiving specifically, I mean, if one is to respond to that, there are, of course, many ways of archiving, oral traditions being one of them. What we've been kind of seeing now increasingly is a kind of a practice of recording oral traditions, which in a way translate them from being oral to a recorded material. And I often ask, because this is a question that I was once asked, so I often ask people who are practitioners of oral tradition or recording oral tradition, how do they actually contend with this kind of attention? And I think one recent response that I got is that they live with the tension of this dissonance between something that is intended to be oral but now is recorded or documented, or the voice or the agency of the voices are in a way preserved for fear of erasure. That it is better for something to kind of be translated, yet work with the idea that this is a recording but not a fixation of the orality, and work with that tension as opposed to allow something to be erased. And that is a very real fear that we are living in today. Of course, as I said, there are multiple other ways of documentation. There's material documentation, there is documentation through perhaps digital technologies, which is something that I'm particularly interested in, specifically because I feel that digital technologies have the potential to offer certain kind of tools and methodologies that take the idea of preservation and archiving of material, non-material, or immaterial heritage and knowledges into a kind of a format where they are not just searchable, more easily accessible, but create a certain kind of a network or a rhizome of systems which can be actually, which become complex, in a way mimicking the complexities of the cultures that they seek to preserve or represent. The real fear, I think, in that is that with the kind of platformization of data that we're seeing today, where data is being extracted more easily than ever before, how can we actually create templates of a kind of a decolonial, free, open source platform of archival material that actually works for the communities, that works on the principles of good data instead of bad data, where bad data is data that is extracted from a top-down perspective, where it does not belong to the people that produce the data, as opposed to that good data, which actually serves the communities that produce this knowledge. So how can we work with principles of good data? These are all questions that within a kind of a digital realm of archiving, one is interested in. So I think that in that sense, archives definitely have the potential to actually work with more than one logics, where it seeks accountability from what I was calling state and infrastructure archives, yet at the same time offers privacy and protection to what may be called indigenous technologies and indigenous modes of knowledge production, knowledge preservation, knowledge transmission, a kind of a venue, as it were. As to the question of how these kind of how the Sahrawi people or the struggle and the resilience of the Sahrawi people can inform this kind of production and transmission, I think that is through the work of Muhammad and what we have heard today, very much apparent that if a community of people have survived and in a way develop new technologies, new methodologies, new ways of living in the 50 years of oppression, I think that already is a lesson that is worth learning. But maybe I'd like Muhammad kind of respond to that part of the question.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Ali. I think I really appreciate your input because it's different when someone documents someone else's life versus when someone documents their own life. It's a statement of representation of identity. And when someone else documents your life, they are speaking in they are speaking on your behalf, and they are stating your reality, and the world knows about you through the statement of someone else. And this is very dangerous. And this is also, again, the colonial practice that has been taking place for a long time. But when we take the initiative to document our life, research it, produce about it, then we represent our ideas, but also for whom such archiving materials are being made. We know historically that a lot of the archiving and a lot of documentation and a lot of, sadly, also the anthropological work has served many colonial practices in the past. But now it's important that we make it for a different reason. We make it because we know this is a culture and this is a way of living that is being endangered. This is the life of my father. This is not the life of someone else. And when I document the life of my father, it's in conversation with my father. I want to know my father. Where does he come from? And this is not an exception. All the other families do it as well. And in doing that, I also give a lesson to the younger generation that we want to know our roots because we have been uprooted from our homeland and we don't belong here. So it's for a different reason. The connection to our homeland manifests itself also through these stories. And a lot of that knowledge actually is becoming very, very important to survive today because the way, the Sahrawi way of living in the desert has a lot of knowledge and insights of how to navigate the desert and how to live in it and how to survive. And I think those lessons are timeless and they become especially important in such times of climate change, of stresses, of conflicts, of all of these challenges that we go through. And in times of limitations, in times of scarcity, what do we do? The nomads have many lessons about that because they lived in minimalistic way of living with as little as possible. But also the way, for example, when I talk to my father and many other elderly in our community, just about living in the desert, there's something about it that it raises questions about these big issues that we have. For example, this ownership of land, these borders, all of these ways of connecting to the landscape around us. When the Sahrawi lived as nomads, they crossed borders all the time because they didn't have this notion of borders. The desert is so big and they lived in countries. I mean, you didn't get to own the desert. And if you live in a nomadic way of living from place to place, you don't get to own those places. You only stay there for momentarily and move on to the next place, celebrate in those places through poetry and stories. This idea of borders, of nations, of possessions of the land is an introduced concept to us. We don't know about it, you know? And it's also very problematic because it tells about human beings in control of something bigger than us. I mean, we live in a very short time, period of time on this earth. How do we get to own something that has existed before us and it's going to exist after us? It's a very stupid idea, you know? And so we need to flip that logic back to something else. And I think the Sahrawi way of living could provide a bit of an insight or a different perspective of how to relate to the land and how to relate to the world around us, that we're not on the top of the pyramid. We're only part of a web or a network of other living things. And that in reality, despite the technology and the material advancements that we have, we only exist in a fraction of time and we only have very small impact on this earth. If we vanish, we vanish. We're a grain of sand in the desert.
Yeah, I think this is circling back, at least in my mind, after being present in all the conversations, it's circling back to these narratives of resilience that we talked early on in this series. And also when we talked about, or one thing that came in through that conversation was also the role of philanthropy and how that can influence, like, what kind of narratives are then, you know, exposed or shared. And I wanted to get some kind of final as thoughts or insights from you to on this role of, you know, hope, resilience, and creative collaborations, and in a way how this how the global community can support also communities like the Sahrawi that are facing these environmental, political challenges. How can we, what are kind of the hopes for the future? And I think this is also something that we've been always trying to include in our conversations. This idea of how can art and science and these global networks, in a way, help support this vision of yours. For example, you were just sharing like how this can kind of inform and be replicated and be spread. So is it just a matter of like the narratives that we're kind of pushing or not pushing for? It was really interesting to hear you talk about scarcity. And a lot of times Colin, who's not here today, but always brings this idea of this scarcity mentality that we have nowadays. And it's so much connected more with, you know, all this need of buying, or if I don't have this or that, I won't be happy. So kind of this marketing machine that we live in. But kind of twisting it around and thinking about like, what are these narratives? How can this creative collaboration bring things forward, and how can, what are your hopes, you know, for the future in terms of support, like from these global networks that are in place?
You know, the word resilience can be sometimes problematic as well. you know, we don't want to portray the Sahrawi way of living as, okay, these people, you know, because that sometimes gets brought up in some narratives around NGOs and international bodies working, even in the camps here or somewhere else, that, okay, these people, look at these people, they have done these amazing things and, you know, we're supporting them. And why I'm so happy about this small-scale family gardens project is that it's an initiative by the Sahrawi. Of course, there is some support from NGOs because there are some material things needed there, but it's an initiative by the Sahrawi. And it's counter, not maybe openly and expressively, it's counter to this other narrative of refugees needing international aid all the time. It's an expression, it's actually, it could be a statement of, hey, we can take care of ourselves.
Definitely.
We can work on creating food. And this is not the issue. When the UN says, okay, the UN brings food to the refugee camps and we support and we do this and that, they have another thing to do, much, much bigger and more important than bringing food. They need to solve the problem, you know, and not bring food, because the Sahrawi have lived in the desert for centuries. They know how to deal with scarcity. They can live with as little as possible. We can live with small things. That's not the problem. And now our community also learn how to farm, so we can produce food. I'm not saying that this can produce self-sufficiency in the community, but it's an example that the Sahrawi can take care of themselves, you know, that the international community has another responsibility to do other than providing that food for the refugee camps. There are vulnerable people in the refugee camps, and they do need food and medical support and other needs to be taken care of. And I'm sure I appreciate all the support from the international supporters and friends of the Sahrawi people. But there is another responsibility that they should not be shadowed by this humanitarian aid, that the Sahrawi and many other indigenous people or many other colonized people, they can take care of themselves, you know. We don't need all of these support, that we're not paralyzed people. We can take care of ourselves, and we have the knowledge and we have the capacity to do it, you know. And the refugee camps are one of the most self-organized camps in the world. For the past 50 years, the Sahrawi people, and especially the Sahrawi women, have built schools. There are schools and hospitals and courts and things in the refugee camps. There are high schools, there are intermediate schools, there are hospitals in all the camps. And in the refugee camps, there are considered one of the most highly educated places in Africa, because we have high percentage of doctors and engineers. But it's a beautiful story in a sad place, because the people who get educated and they come back to the refugee camps, they can't practice much of that knowledge in the refugee camps, you know. But as an example of how people can take care of themselves, it's a very good example, because of all of these. And also, we have a film school, we have a school of cinema, a school of arts, a school of music, with you know, programs going on and everything. So, you know, people can take care of themselves, and that's not the problem, you know. And so resilience can be problematic in that sense. That's, that okay,
of course. Yeah, and I think the way that you are portraying resilience, that's kind of the interesting side, yeah, also of resilience and what we want to highlight. And I think the conversation that came up before on about philanthropy and how the system is like wrapped up around it, it's also about that, you know, that all the nonprofits, other organizations, they kind of need to prove themselves, like we have a good idea or we have a good vision or mission or whatever. And then someone in power will decide if this is worth or not putting their money resources into. And so it makes everyone kind of stuck in that system, right? And then I think that this narrative of resilience, in the sense that, you know, this proof of autonomy and ability and agency, I think that's kind of the thing that should be highlighted, and then therefore the thing that this global networks or whatever can also share about and highlight.
Yeah, but also this the concept of climate justice, that for example, not everyone is contributing to these global problems, not just to climate justice, but this global responsibility toward all of these public crises that we are facing, that we're not all contributing to this problem, that we should be clear about who's responsible and who should be held accountable yes, for those you know, problems. And I think most of the global South is not really contributing to those problems. Sadly, I learned recently that there was a conference in the African Union about what is it called, carbon market or something. Dal Ibrahim was part of it, and that they're debating how, you know, the African countries have a very low carbon footprint, and that many other Western countries are buying their carbon credit in order to offset
Pollute
their credit.
more.
And for a very, very low rate, like I don't know what are the numbers that he shared with me, but it's very problematic that this is another layer of colonizing even those rights that are hardly reaching the conversation, hardly reaching the surface. And we need new measures to point out who's responsible for all of these problems.
Exactly. And who's accountable also. So we need accountability, right? So, and I wanted to, we're kind of running out of time, unfortunately, but I would like to bring up one thing. So Colin, our other speaker, he has often spoken about how poetry is also like a force for change, and its role in building resilience and empathy in a world that's facing so much division, displacement, and all the crises that we're facing. And usually Colin reads one of his poems. And today, when I found out that he couldn't join us today, I kind of thrown the challenge to Ali, who also writes poetry, if we could share one of his poems with us, that would make sense for him for the topic that we've been talking about. So, yeah, I will pass the floor on to you.
Yes, thank you, Colin, for calling in so that I can finally read my poem. No, but jokes apart. No, I think the what we've been talking about, and we've been talking about a lot of things today, especially. And there's a poem that I wrote which is specifically looking at the practice of planting pine trees in Jerusalem. And I would like to read that poem if it's okay with you. It's slightly lo long, so Ines, please feel free to stop me whenever you feel like it. Here goes. A pine tree in Jerusalem. Who knew where to plant that pine? Planting a pine tree in the Jerusalem forest is a narrow path signal to lay down roots, to grow a sustainable future. Of strengthening the bond between the Jewish people and their homeland.
I want to see.
Signaling a turn, a return to a land once known by another's name. Who lived in it, where they dispersed? Was dispersal their will, or were they coerced? My relation with Palestine is tenuous at best, having lived in Mumbai, a concrete, vertical, high-density jungle. With tree pockets few and far between. Dwindling forest renamed a path. Bureaucracies that undervalue trees chop in favor of wider roads, boulevards, malls, and capitalism. Perhaps I truly understood the value of trees only in Finland, not economic value, where 75% of Finland is forested. And yet, as the most forested country in Europe, 61% of it is privately owned. 20 million hectares slated for wood production, dubbed lapis pine, hailed as green gold. Not economic value, as counted by the EU, that labels trees and crops as green energy, subsidized to dirty EU coal power plants that burn trees and crops en masse as renewable. No, not economic value. Where the value of rest and growth, of sitting in forests that soothe with a green windy caress, a value of tending, nurturing, and growing, of turning the soil and simulating rain, pink lights to fake sunlight, brewing teas that make plants happy. I'm surrounded by people who love trees and plant as a way of life. Slowly, I've learned to find ways to fit in with them. These people and the trees. And when I think of the hands that planted those pine trees, that form the forest in the Judean hills of occupied Jerusalem. I imagine hands that nurtured and cared, that found soil and water, that tended and mended. How did those hands then manifest such hate? Turn and break lives, bomb buildings, shoot people? How did those hands push and push and push people out of their homes, their land, their forests? If those hands wanted to build, why did they build that god-awful wall? Jerusalem pine, as it is known in its bloodied occupied land, Aleppo pine, its name true, is found growing naturally across Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, and Spain, north to southern France, Malta, Italy, Croatia, Montenegro, Albania, and east to Greece. From here, replanted and forested across Syria, Lebanon, southern Turkey, Jordan, and now Palestine. Biologically known as Pineus halepensis, is a Christian, Arab, Jew, or soon is all of it EU. To visit Jerusalem forest in the Judean hills of occupied Jerusalem is the 164th of 329 things to do according to TripAdvisor. When I say forest, might you imagine an expanse of trees enduring, or for centuries, surviving war, upheavals, conquests and defeats, marking time, awaiting a return of another better time? And yet, with the first tree planted only in 1956, was the forest birth. So who may plant pine in Jerusalem? How far back their provenance goes? Who asserts the right to say, this land I'm owed? This land, my own, my precious. Why did you plant a pine, I asked. Why plant over the wet watermelons? Why replace the Mediterranean oak, terebinth, carob, maquis, shrubland, and gari? Who knew where to plant that pine that allows no underbrush, that deprives Palestinian shepherds of pasture, that create ecological desert, mirroring cultural deserts? Planting a pine tree fronts an afforestation program with ecological sounding stated goals. Soil conservation, erosion prevention, greenhouse gas reduction, and biodiversity proliferation. One may assume that planting trees is always benevolent, and yet the 4 million conifers in the Yatir forest cause more warming than cooling. Dark leaves absorb the radiation previously reflected into space by empty desert sand. Planting a pine tree forest has deep cultural motivation of enforcing Zionist commandments. It was at first a transitional excuse that manifested a national propaganda ballooned as a transnational narrative of a place that died when Jews were exiled, a shemama where nobody lived and nothing grew. A less than underdeveloped wasteland, wasted in the unskilled Arab hands who knew not how to properly cultivate it. Planting a pine tree forest costs $18 per tree, a price that has remained the same despite 20 years worth of inflation. A number coinciding with Jewish numerology, 18 that signifies life, although it's clear whose life is prioritized. Who took what by force, and who was forced out of her home? For $18, a certified tree planted on your behalf. For $180, your name in the golden book inscribed. For $1,800, your name on the wall of eternal life entombed. Planting a pine tree forest is a deep-seated desire to strengthen bonds between the Jewish people and the perceived homeland. A strengthening planned in part by expelling Palestinians from newly occupied land, preventing return by destroying Arab villages, building Jewish settlements, or planting pine over the ruins of Arab villages to obscure them. Planned by Yosef Weitz, the beloved father of the forests, a plan dependent in part by donations collected globally and the refusal of a people to look below the tree line. Planting a pine tree forest links ecology and aesthetics to cultural survival. Can planting trees be a form of ecological warfare, where each seed thumped into the earth is a bullet, shots fired upon a people? Quasi-weaponized trees, cultivated on hate, biological harbingers of Jewish sovereignty that say, look, we are here. We reclaimed this barren earth. We made the desert bloom and made it acceptable, made it European green. A pine tree landscape paints Jewish occupation as an ecological necessity to wish away the Palestinian problem. It enforces Jewish stewardship, legitimizes its territorial claims in the way one would throw a handkerchief on a train seat to reserve it. Trees become proxy Jews, become spectators, become citizens in ways that Palestinians, Arabs, and Bedouins never can. A pine tree landscape in Jerusalem stands tall over the village, over the villages of Alar, Dair al-Hawa, Kirbat al-Tanur, Jarash, Sufla, Bayt Itar, and Dair Abban. Depopulated of their 4,000 inhabitants, captured and raised in the Nakba. In the hills of western Jerusalem, a forest established on the homes of 4,600 Palestinians, the villages of Bayt Jez, Bayt Masjid, Bayt Sustin, Saris, and Islam. At Martyrs Trees Planwood, Bayt Al-Mais, Kirbat Al-Umur, and Kasla. The list goes on. What must be like for that pine tree to be living in sacred sites profane, as weaponized righteousness, as beliefs displayed and badges that kill? Does that pine tree planted in the Jerusalem forest ask if the story of Palestine is simply the story of land? Ponder about rights, covenants, othering and dominance, histories and identities of prominence? Does it wonder, where should Palestinians go now after 74 years of forced exile to plant pine trees that memorialize their own lost ones? Thank you.
Thank you, Ali. Maybe you could write the name, the title of the poem and the poet in the chat if anyone wants to, you know, kind of read it again. And I think that, well, we need to wrap up, but I think that this just really highlights, you know, in a way also the importance of dialogue and collaboration, and you know, and how the world can in a way work towards the same purpose and not focus on the our differences. And I want to thank both of you for being here today and for your insights, for sharing. Mohammed, I would love for you to show your location because it's so beautiful out there. And we speakers got the privilege of looking around a bit with. Maybe you can, you're muted. I don't know if he's saying something. What? This is the spot where the internet was the best for this connection, so, and where Mohammed was talking to us from.
Okay. I was just saying this is just outside Samara camp. Samara camp is just over there, but I came here because of the internet. But yes.
It was really great to have you. Thanks for joining. And I would like to invite everyone to attend our sixth and last conversation in this series in November. And we will be announcing as usual in our Instagram channels and subscribe our newsletter. We also inform everyone through there. You can follow Artists with Evidence on social media. And if you're interested in contributing and supporting us, we are very happy about that too. And there's many ways in which people can contribute and support a nonprofit organization. We will keep on engaging in these programs and bringing art science as much as we can to a broad audience. It was really great to have people joining from so many different places today. There was also a comment, a really nice comment from someone that had spent some time in the camps in 2007. So you might recognize the name, Ashley Hayden.
He was my teacher many years ago in the camps.
English teacher. And said that she experienced nothing but warmth, hospitality and friendships from the Sahrawi people. So I think that's a really nice note and a more personal note, but I wanted to, you know, still share it. And thanks everyone for joining, and we'll see you again in November and with Ali and Alan and the new guests, which we'll announce soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ines, and thank you, Mohammed. Bye.
Yeah, thank you all. Bye-bye.
Echo Effect. Conversations on War and Environment is a program funded by the Nordic Culture Fund, who awarded artists with evidence with the Globus Opstart Grant for 2024.